From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Today, most of America's children head to class for another day at public school. Some kids thrive in there. Other kids, not so much. This hour, we'll explore what happens when learning happens outside the box.
Rather than having one simple public school with one simple curriculum and one simple pedagogical apparatus for all kids to go to, there'll be a vast array of schools and possibilities. And that's all good. We should be moving towards diversity, not away from it.
Author Matt Hearn on the case for de-schooling. Also, the music of Dan Zanes and why the former rocker isn't about preaching or teaching to kids.
What I wanted was just a shared experience. I wanted to make music not for kids. I wanted to make music for families because I wanted music that I could connect with emotionally that my daughter could also connect with.
And novelist Sherman Alexie writes a novel for his sons to help them find the lessons in a violent world.
How do you tell the difference between the good and the bad guys when they say the same things? But also, how do you tell the difference between the good and the bad guys when they do the same things?
Jonathan Mooney's got great credentials. He graduated from Brown University with a degree in honors English. He's the author of two books and the president of Project Eye to Eye, a nonprofit advocacy organization for students with learning disabilities. Mooney looks great on paper. But if you'd met him in grade school, you'd never peg him as a big achiever. Recently, Mooney toured the country on a refurbished short bus, the bus kids with so-called disabilities ride. He writes about the experience in his book, The Short Bus, A Journey Beyond Normal. Mooney says being labeled as learning disabled was incredibly hard for him as a kid.
Well, it had very tangible impact on my educational trajectory. I dropped out of school for a year in sixth grade. I had a plan for suicide that year. I was 12 years old. I really found my sense of self almost entirely in my athletic ability as a soccer player, which was a blessing, obviously. I don't think I would be the person I am today if I didn't have that opportunity to be successful at something, which is a really important thing for any mom or dad who's listening. You need to find an opportunity for young people to be successful at something. It doesn't have to be athletics, whatever it is for them. But it also was a curse. I really sort of put my entire self into the box of being the stupid jock, you know, the stupid athlete, you know, the person who felt he didn't have a mind. And it was a tremendous personal and lifelong struggle. And frankly, a big part of The Short Bus as a narrative, as a story, is about that struggle with being told that my mind was defective, which is a pretty devastating thing for somebody to be told at a young age. And with how I unlearned that message and how I came to have a different sense of self.
But it's clear that this experience that you went through is central to your life. It's something you're never going to forget. And it appears to be what drove you to this journey beyond normal, as the subtitle of your book has it, that you were inspired to write this because of all the other kids who are going through the same thing?
I was inspired to go on this journey, and let me explain that term a little bit. In every sense of the word, the book, The Short Bus, was a journey. I mean, I literally bought an old special ed school bus, which is the type of bus that takes a lot of kids with physical and cognitive differences to segregated special ed programs, a bus that I experienced as a young person. I bought an old short school bus, which is really just a smaller bus than the so-called normal bus. I converted it into an RV, and I journeyed around America. I went 35,000 miles, 4 months, almost all 50 states. And I really, through other people's stories and my own story, explored the concept of what it means to be normal in our culture. And not just what it means to be normal, but how that is a really tyrannical idea. You know, the imperative of be normal, of fix this about yourself and you will be normal, of the policies that we historically have implemented that have been guided by normalcy, such as eugenic policies that emerged in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, which led to a lot of state policies where you could be forcibly sterilized by the state government if you were deemed abnormal or defective. So I wanted to really journey into what I think is a not commonly talked about form of tyranny in our culture, and that is the idea of you should be normal.
Hmm. You met a girl later on, not too much later, a girl with Down syndrome. You were talking about living a normal life, and she really did, unless you examine the word normal too closely, I guess. What did you learn about her?
Well, I learned before I get to Katie, and her name is Katie Bassford, and she lives in Seaman, Ohio, which is a small farming town in southwestern Ohio that sort of rides the seam of Appalachia and the Appalachia Mountains. I learned from her the distinction that you rightfully pointed out, which is a distinction between normal as people experience it in their everyday life and normal as a concept that we impose and strive for. Normal as a concept that we impose and strive for is, in reality, anything but normal. You know, we kind of present the white upper middle class striver as normal. Well, that's not 99.9% of the human population, right? That's not the norm. If anything, it's aberrant. And what you see in Katie's life is the power of really taking people at their own norm and allowing them to define normal for themselves and allowing them to have a sort of very personal definition of what a meaningful life constitutes. You know, Katie as an individual with Down syndrome is really a endangered species. And these are her words and her mom's words. Many of your listeners may not know that 98% or around 95% of women who are given a diagnosis of Down syndrome in utero choose abortion. So really, as genetic testing improves, as prenatal testing improves, Down syndrome is a type of human being, a way of being that is threatened, is endangered. And what I learned from Katie is that if we lost people like Katie, it would be a irreparable, tragic loss, not just for Katie, but it would be a loss for all of us. There's an amazing moment at the end of my time at the Bassford family farm where Katie's mom turns to me and says, you know, we're like a rainforest. And I didn't really know what that metaphor meant. And so I pushed her and she said, we're all interdependent like a rainforest. If one part of this rainforest, no matter how insignificant people conceive that part to be, if we lose that, we all lose something of ourselves. And she's right. And I think that that analogy or metaphor to biodiversity, right, the concept that we need all these different types of species and grasses and ecosystems and trees to maintain a healthy global ecosystem, that same analogy is carried forward to different types of human beings. We need the difference like Katie, because in some way we don't quite understand, we are all interdependent. And if there's no place for Katie in our culture, who's next?
There's one more of your visits that I really do want to talk about because he's an amazing guy. Jeff Woodhead. He, you wrote, gave you one of the most beautiful gifts you've ever received. Will you tell us what it was?
It's important to understand the context of the gift, first and foremost. I spent a day with a man named Jeff in Davis, California. And from the very beginning of my interactions with Jeff, it was obvious that he was way on the other side of normal. He was an obsessive list maker and timer. And it became apparent in my time with Jeff that he would be labeled, though he wasn't at the time, he would be labeled Asperger's, which is a form of high-functioning autism. So at the very end of my time with Jeff, literally with his clock ticking with about 10 minutes left to go, Jeff asked me if I wanted to see his books of poetry. And of course I did. And he showed me his books of poetry. And then he offered to copy the poetry for me so I could take it home. And we went to Kinko's. When we got to Kinko's, we had 5 minutes left in our stopwatch. And Jeff was furiously copying away. And there came to a point where it was obvious that we were going to exceed our time, which is a real issue for Jeff. He controlled his whole reality through time and timing. And he looked at me, he looked at his book of poetry, he looked at the stopwatch, he looked at me again, And then he kept copying his poetry. And we ran 15 minutes late. For a man like Jeff, running that 15 minutes late was a monumental sacrifice in the way that he made sense of the world.
Did you, in your travels, ever find a place where Jeff's normal, your normal, Katie's normal, was normal?
In the fabric of community, the thing that I learned from this is in grounded communities, in communities in which people have authentic relationships with their neighbors, in which communities in which people are included and engaged and allowed to live independently, even if that requires support, it's only in the fabric of community where Katie can be Katie, not Down syndrome, where Jeff can be Jeff, not autism. Something happens when institutional knowledge trumps community personal knowledge. What happens is people become abstractions, they become labels, they become diagnoses, they become things to be treated and cured. It's in community, which is a challenge because community is being eroded in America. It's in community where everyone has an opportunity to define their normal.
Jonathan Mooney is the author of The Short Bus and president of Project Eye to Eye, a nonprofit advocacy organization for students with learning disabilities. Dan Zanes isn't your typical kids' musician. In fact, he's more about pleasing the whole family. Zanes used to be a member of the rock band The Del Fuegos, but gave it up to make kids' music. His album, Catch That Train, won the Grammy in 2007 for Best Musical Album for Children. Zanes wants to teach kids and their families about music by proving that everyone can make music. He told Anne Strange Champs how he got started.
I was looking for a particular sound that I couldn't find. I had a sound in my head. It was essentially the updated version of the Folkways records that I grew up with. Pete Seeger, Lead Belly, Ella Jenkins, Woody Guthrie. For me, those were records. They had traditional songs. They had new songs that people wrote. It sounded like everybody was gathering together in a house somewhere. It really didn't sound like a recording studio in any way.
Everybody's talking about a day up at the lake. So let's get our bags and guitars and all the food that we can take. I'll meet you on the corner when the sun decides to break. So
catch the train.
Oh, come on out and catch it.
Catch the train.
There was a sense of fun and sort of a depth to the lyrics in those songs that I always liked. And I thought, well, that's the template right there. It's all made by hand. And that's really what I thought I would find on the shelves when I walked into Tower Records. And it seemed very, very corporate. And I couldn't find that handmade sound that I was after.
Oh, come on out and catch it.
Catch the train.
Was it also for you about giving kids a sound that was, I don't know, a little hipper, a little cooler? I mean, rather than that sort of more sentimentalized kids' music?
No. In my experience, as soon as I had a child, the idea of being hip and cool goes out the window. You know, the first time you change a diaper on a park bench, I think the idea of being cool, it evaporates right then and there. And I was relieved, too, because I spent so much of my life trying to be cool. Man, I was happy to let that one go. You know, what I wanted was just a shared experience. I wanted to make music, not for kids. I wanted to make music for families because I wanted music that I could connect with emotionally, that my daughter could also connect with. That's the key, I think, to what we do is the adults are just as important as the kids. We try not to leave anybody behind. In other words, we're not singing songs about learning to tie your shoes or put on trousers or eat with a fork, because that you would lose the grown-ups. But I'm also not singing songs about drinking and old girlfriends, because what three-year-old is going to relate to any of that?
I'm thinking a quintessential song that you just imagine parents and kids, whole families,
right,
kind of really dancing to is Let's Shake.
Oh.
Put your arms out to the side.
Trying to tap into my what I felt like when I first started playing in a rock and roll band and just how primal it all was. Rock and roll, especially in a sort of a garage band format, rock and roll was really set me up well for family music because there's always that spirit of we can do anything we want, we can sing anything we want, the sky's the limit. And that's really how I feel about doing this now, is just every day is a new set of possibilities. But the difference now for me is that what I really believe we have to offer, and in addition to the sense that it's a shared musical experience, is also the feeling that you could do this too. This is something that anybody could do. You know, I hope you like the records, and I really hope they're a stepping stone for you to go and make your own music.
One of the things I really like is you kind of rescued songs that I haven't thought about for years. I mean, one of my favorites that you've done, for instance, is Loch Lomond, an old Scottish folk song. I mean, I probably learned it in, you know, third grade music class and I haven't thought about it since then. But you do this version with Natalie Merchant that, I mean, it could be sung at a roots music festival the way you do it. I mean, what did you do to make it sound that way?
Well, we ate lunch, and Natalie had baked some cookies, and we told some jokes and got to know each other, and then we hung around and played. I mean, that's really it. You know, I think you bring some food into it, and you get to know and appreciate the person that you're making music with, and the songs come alive. It's so mysterious and weird. I can't get over it, but that's the process, is you love the people that you're with, and you try and create the best time for everybody. And the music reflects that. I guess it's simple and easy, but it's also very mysterious. I think the world of Natalie, and to be able to do that song with her, there's so much emotion in that song. And when I hear her voice, it's, you know, I always get choked up.
Mind where we parted in young shady glen, on the steep, steep side of Ben Lomond, where in deep purple hues the highland hills review, and the moon coming out.
You know, I was going to ask you earlier a question about kid music, which I think sort of traditionally has been kind of didactic. I mean, the songs that I remember growing up with, and I guess that I played for my kids probably when they were little, were a lot of like ABC songs or kind of free to be you and me kind of things. You know, they really are didactic, intended to teach either the numbers or the alphabet or the golden rule. And I was wondering if your music does try to teach anything.
I've never considered myself an educator of any sort. I'm an entertainer. But I'm always trying to think, what are people going to get out of this? And I think for me, if people come to the shows or listen to the CDs, what I hope most is that people come out of it with a sense of life's possibilities that they might not have had before. They're either looking up at the stage and being able to identify with one of the people on the stage playing an instrument in some way. They're able to picture themselves up there doing the same thing. You know, I was kind of a lonely, scared kid up in New Hampshire, and I would listen to records, and it opened up these windows to the world. And it really helped me to try and figure out what was out there for me. And that's what we try and do, give people a sense of life's possibilities, a curiosity about each other, and a sense of open-heartedness towards each other. I mean, it sounds like a lot, but really, on the other hand, we're just hanging out with our friends, playing a bunch of tunes and eating lunch.
I was going to say, you've gotten some amazing musical talent to collaborate with you. I mean, people like the Kronos Quartet, Philip Glass, Lou Reed, Deborah Harry. I mean, these aren't the kind of people that you normally associate with, I don't know, kid culture or even family culture. I mean, how did you get them to collaborate, and what do they say about what the experience is like?
Sometimes I have to do a lot of begging, and then sometimes it just couldn't be easier. You know, someone like Roseanne Cash, I met her in the West Village here in New York, and she knew about what I was doing, and she knew of me, and she said, you know, if you ever want me to do anything, just let me know. I mean, and she's become such a good friend, and every situation is different, but it's always inspirational in one way or another. You know, say the Five Blind Boys come over to your house for lunch, and this is actually the way it worked with them, but they came over to my house for lunch. We rehearsed at the dining room table, and then we went in the living room and recorded a song.
I'm gonna sit at the welcome
table.
Sit at the welcome table one of these days. Hallelujah.
I'm
gonna sit at the welcome
table.
Sit at the welcome table one of these days. One of these days.
I mean, we want it to be artful, but really to give that idea that, you know, this music, it lives in people's homes, it lives in the neighborhood, it lives in the community, and this is, you can do this too.
Hallelujah, I'm gonna feast on milk and honey.
Feast
on milk and honey. One of these days, one of these days.
Yes,
gonna sit at the welcome table.
One of your songs, I confess, it kind of makes me cry sometimes, is Moonlit Town, that your daughter sings on with you. I think the reason that that song in particular makes me tear up is it conveys so much of what I feel about having kids and living in a close neighborhood. And it's something about ordinary life, which is both at the same time not special and just infinitely precious altogether.
Oh, boy, I agree with that. Our records are always a mix of the old and the new, mostly the old. But I do like to have a completed song. But I feel like everything I would ever need to write about is within 2 miles of my house. It's all right there. Everyday life is so filled with mystery and possibility. And just there's so many layers to it all. The little things can become so big. It's really, I mean, I didn't know that until I started doing this all-ages music. I was so locked into what I thought a rock and roll song had to be, but this has completely opened up songwriting for me.
The sun is gone now, stoves are on now, outside there's silver on the ground, in a moonlit town.
Dan Zanes won a Grammy in 2007 for his album Catch That Train. He's a former member of the rock band The Del Fuegos and a father. His latest album is called Nueva York. And by the way, if your child wants to learn an instrument, Zanes says, go for a ukulele. Coming up, why one alternative schooling expert says traditional 5-day-a-week schools need to evolve and fast. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Matt Hearn is a Canadian advocate for alternative education. He's the author of the book Field Day and the editor of De-Schooling Our Lives. He told Steve Paulson that the model for public education should mirror other public places, like parks and libraries.
If you think about the institutions which matter tremendously to us and are the best of our common cultural life, most of us think of libraries or museums or parks or pools or walkways or bikeways. And even if you want to expand it to other public institutions like hospitals or bridges or roads, for example, those are all, you know, good. But none of them are compulsory. None of them are required to go. So I love libraries, but I would like them a whole lot less if people told me that I had to go, when I had to go, what I had to do when I was there, and how I would behave when I was in a library. So the bulk of my argument, or at least the simplest part of the argument, is that I would like schools to look a whole lot more like actually public institutions. Not mandatory, not compulsory, and not monopolizing institutions, but institutions which function in our communities in the way that, for example, parks or libraries do.
I'm trying to wrap my head around what this would actually mean in terms of how public schools would be run, for instance. I mean, are you saying that it would just be up to every individual family whether they'd want to send their kids to school or not?
I'm arguing for what Subcomandante Marcos Zapatistas would call localization, which is interpreting the idea of what kids need to thrive in a local way. So what it looks like in terms of attendance, I think, is could and should and would be incredibly diverse. But the question I think is the really interesting one is that we think of libraries or museums or parks as integral parts to our cultural and social life. In the same way that we think, or hospitals, for example, that we think of schools, but why do we make kids go? Why do we deem it as absolutely necessary? Why do we deem it as mandatory for all children to go? And if parents don't send their kids, they're being somehow delinquent.
I think we do it because we want them to get an education, right?
For sure. I mean, who doesn't want that? And one of the key things that I've learned, because I've run small schools and I've run youth centers over the last 20 years, is that I think that we can say about all kids, and there's almost nothing you can say about all kids, but that there's virtually no kids who want to grow up to be stupid and ignorant and lazy and incompetent. People all want to grow up to be interesting and competent and self-reliant and capable of defining their own lives and doing things they're interested in. And if we take that as a basic starting point, then I think the idea of mandatory schooling begins to lose a whole lot of its steam.
But you're saying that too often schools are slaves to the curriculum, to the requirements.
Yeah, I would say, in fact, virtually always. And I work with teachers all over the country, all over, well, both Canada and the United States, and that is the truth. That is the definition of school, in fact, of being slave to the curriculum. That is, by definition, what the compulsory school project is about. I'll tell you about my 9-year-old just for a second, because it's an easy one. So my 9-year-old goes to an alternative school. It's a democratic school in Vancouver, so it's a small school where kids have the whole school's parents, staff, and kids all have one person, one vote, and all the school rules and all the implementation of those rules. It's got an alternative pedagogical approach, and it's a cool little place. And it's a publicly funded school, so it's got a relatively diverse student body, and it's free. It's a good place. But my 9-year-old, she doesn't want to go all the time. Actually, no, I take that back. Actually, now that she's 9, when she was really little, she really didn't want to go all the time. But now that she's 9, I think she would like to go about 5 days a week. But what I've noticed is that the sort of relentless socialization that happens around that age begins, she gets kind of sketchy, is the best word I can say, is if she kind of wigs out a little bit with the amount of socialization. And so on Mondays, she stays home with my partner, who is actually a teacher as well at that school. And on Tuesdays, she stays home with me. And then she goes to school Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Takes a full roster of classes.
And the school doesn't have any problem with
that. No, that's correct. The school is set up for kids to be on flexible schedules like that. And for me, that works really well because I get a full day off when I don't work and I hang out with her. And what we usually do is we take two or three of her friends. In fact, we always take two or three of her friends and we go on a field trip together. Hmm. So every Tuesday we go on a field trip. So it allows me time to hang out with my kid by myself with her friends. We get to go out of the city. We get to do, because we live downtown. We get to go out of the city. We get to hang out. And, almost always we go hiking or go swimming out somewhere or go out in the bush. And to me, it seems to work really well for her. Now, that's a fluid conversation between us.
Mm-hmm. You've laid out a philosophical orientation, but a lot of this comes down to politics, quite frankly. And, yep. I mean, there are state rules. Well, I can't speak for Canada, but certainly in the United States, mm-hmm. there are all kinds of requirements, legal requirements that the state imposes on what it means to have an education. There's the teachers' union. You're fighting an uphill battle here.
In some ways, you'd think so, but in other ways, not really. And in some ways, I think I'm kind of going with the flow. And that what you're seeing is an incredibly, this is obviously not No Child Left Behind Act, which is specifically about homogenizing and monoculturing our school system, specifically. And I won't talk too much more about it, and probably because you guys know vastly more. But everything that I know and everything I've witnessed traveling around North America for the last 10 years, I guess, I've been traveling around speaking in communities, visiting places, visiting schools. The No Child Left Behind Act is specifically running exactly against the grain of what I'm arguing for here. That said, what I see all over North America, and I see incredibly powerfully in Vancouver where I come from, is this drive towards a diversity of educational and pedagogical opportunities. So, for example, in Vancouver right now, in British Columbia, you can go to college, and we have a college system and then a university system. A college is like a two-year system. I think you call them community colleges mm-hmm. here. But you can do 2 years at a college, and then you go directly into a third-year university, into your junior year university. But to get into college in British Columbia, you have to be 19, irregardless of your academic background. So you could have never have gone to school ever in your life. And I've got several kids that I'm involved with who have been long-term unschoolers that have never gone to school and just turned 19 and immediately entered college and are doing great, and they're on the university track. So that's one thing that undermines, because that's what they tell us all in high school. Is if you don't graduate from high school, you're never going to go to university and you're never going to get a job and you're going to be a loser and you're going to be homeless. I mean, that's the kind of, you know, the thing that they throw out there. In Vancouver and, well, in British Columbia, that's explicitly undermined. You can never go to high school. You don't have to go to high school, and you can go to college. Now, it doesn't mean you can just sit around and play video games all the time and then just go to college and expect to do fine. But the idea that you have to go to high school to go to college is not true. There's something else that's happening in British Columbia high schools now, for example, is that there are many things that you're able to substitute for traditional classes. That is to say, there's things like if you take a ski instructor's course, you're allowed to substitute that for your physical education requirement. There's a whole bunch of things that you're allowed to take, courses that are available in the community or work experience that you're allowed to take and substitute.
So you could opt out of gym class, which a lot of kids hate, frankly.
Well, exactly. And there might be much better ways to go about fulfilling that requirement. But once you begin to walk down that road and go, okay, well, hang on, maybe there's another way to get your math 12. Maybe you can do that online. Maybe you can do that distance. Maybe you can do that by doing an internship in the community. Maybe you can do that just learning it by yourself. When you begin to recognize there's multitudes of paths to get to competencies and skills, then I believe this idea of schools as being the holder of necessary knowledge as the only professional way, the only certifiable, state-certifiable way that knowledge can be dispensed, as soon as we begin to break that down, then the world begins to open up pedagogically for our kids. And I think that you begin to find kids a whole lot different ways, a whole lot more diverse ways, a whole lot more appropriate ways for kids to engage with knowledge and skills and competencies other than just simply going to school.
Now, you've talked about some of the schooling options where you live in Vancouver. Are you seeing many inroads in other parts? I mean, talk about the United States, for instance. I mean, is there a growing deschooling movement?
Yeah, you know, and certainly there's. I mean, certainly a hugely growing, you know, homeschooling movement. That's for sure. Probably something like 1.5 million kids are being homeschooled right now. And there's some progressive communities like, what was it recently? I was in Eugene,
Oregon.
Yeah, Eugene, Oregon. And there's a couple of charter schools there. There's a Democratic school. There's a Quaker school that's kind of interesting. There's a couple other independent or / publicly funded school. And then I was sitting and talking with a woman who runs a homeschool center. They've got classes all day long for different kids. So homeschool kids can just come and take a class of their choosing, and then they can stay all day and take classes all day, or they can leave. And I was asking her how it was going. She says, well, it's, you know, our enrollment's down this year. I said, oh, yeah. And she says, it's at 700. I said, 700 kids? Well, you know, you're kidding me, you know. And so there's an unschooling movement. There's a homeschooling movement. There are a number of alternative schools of all different kinds of stripes. And there's a fairly wide variety in the public school system. That's just in Eugene, Oregon. And that's, you know, of course, true in some communities and less true in other places. But what you see is, you know, sometimes you see private schools, you see Montessori schools springing up, you're seeing other schools attempting to diversify. There's magnet schools, there's charter schools, there's a whole variety of, and yeah, everywhere I go is I see people grappling with the same issue, which is how to diversify this in a way that makes equitable sense across the community. And I cannot imagine that 30 or 40 years from now we're going to be sitting having the same conversation. Compulsory schooling is only 150 years old in America. The first compulsory schooling laws were passed in Massachusetts in 1852. That's really not that long ago. And I can't imagine that compulsory schooling in a diverse society is going to last. I think that when we have this conversation, even 20 years from now, we're going to be having an entirely different conversation.
Matt Hearn is the editor of the book Deschooling Our Lives. He lives in Vancouver, Canada. He talked with Steve Paulson. Michael Pihowsky studies the inner lives of gifted and talented children. He's the author of Mellow Out, They Say, If I Only Could. Pihowsky says one hallmark of gifted children is the intensity in which they experience their lives.
They experience their life in many more dimensions with great intensity and sensitivity. They are simply told very often in many different ways, as the title of the book is Mellow Out, you know, cool down.
Yeah.
Chill out, you know.
When you talk about their experiencing things more intensely, does it mean that colors are more vivid, that their imagination is more active? What?
That's right. Their mind keeps going all the time, and they have often a hard time shutting it down. So they have to use different strategies for going to sleep, for instance, or just tire themselves out.
Yeah.
And the awareness of what's going around them, what's going in the world, they draw conclusions, they know how to extrapolate, and they can be very frightened by the world situation or what's happening. That's why some parents, for instance, decide that they cannot let their children watch the news.
I wonder, do you have stories of kids that you've worked with?
Yeah, well, that's what I collected in this book. I put together a questionnaire, which was very long. I don't know whether you could get kids to answer questions, you know, 46 open-ended questions today. But they wrote, many of them, very extensive answers. One boy said, "Often I get bursts of energy that make me twitch or jump, as if suddenly shocked with the high dosage of electricity." Uh-huh. And another one said, "When I ask, when do you feel the most energy?" And he said, "It would be easier to tell you when I don't feel the most energy. It's always there."
One of the other things that seems common among these children is that they have very vivid imaginations.
Not only that, but they are capable of actually living in the things that are imagined. And that raises the question of the nature of reality, because even though from brain studies that those people can imagine things vividly, the brain doesn't know the difference between whether it's in the inner reality or in the outer reality.
Does that have any effect on their spiritual nature? Do their spiritual worlds grow at the same pace as their intellectual worlds, their imaginary worlds?
Well, that needs to be studied too. But it is interesting that when we talk about the intensity and sensitivities and the vividness of experience, that because of this, they are able to enter into what looks like a spiritual experience more easily than other children. And that comes from the work that I've been doing in guided imagery based on psychosynthesis, which is a well-developed approach to fostering personal growth, which also involves spiritual growth. And as I have done that with junior high school and high school students in Ohio, some of them had really very interesting, genuine spiritual experiences.
Do you remember any that you could relate to us?
For instance, one of the exercises is to watch in your mind opening of a rosebud. And then the rosebud opens, looking into inside the rosebud and seeing if there is some kind of message for the person. And this girl reported this experience. "My heart seemed to glow and beams of light pierced within me. My heart appeared in all its illumination. The beams of light shot out of it and the heart was the same color as the rose. The heart did not speak to me, but the message was that this is where all my passions and energy arise from." So this description that she gives really is a very real experience of the deeper self, because she's in touch with her heart and she finds out where all her passion and energy arise from. That's the kind of thing that psychosynthesis is designed for, to lead to these kinds of experiences.
These are the things that I imagine kids would have difficulty sharing.
Yes. They share it only with people they can trust. And trust is not easy to find in this world.
Michael Pihowsky studies the lives of gifted and talented children. He's the author of Mellow Out, They Say, If I Only Could. Coming up, novelist Sherman Alexie on war, 9/11, and fatherhood. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. When you're a writer, you don't have to give your kids a book to teach them about war. You can write them one instead. That's what critically acclaimed writer Sherman Alexie did for his two sons in the wake of 9/11. The book is called Flight, a novel. It features the narrator Zitz, a half-Irish, half-Native American boy, who travels back in time into the bodies of participants in key violent conflicts. Here's Alexei reading from Flight. In the voice of his character, Zitz.
I've lived in 20 different foster homes and attended 22 different schools. I own only 2 pairs of pants and 3 shirts and 4 pairs of underwear and 1 baseball hat and 3 pairs of socks and 3 paperback novels, Grapes of Wrath, Winter in the Blood, and The Dead Zone, and the photographs of my mother and father. My entire life fits into one small backpack. I don't know any other Native Americans except for the homeless Indians who wander around downtown Seattle. I like to run away from my foster homes and get drunk with those street Indians. Yeah, I'm a drunk, just like my father. I'm a good drunk, too, gifted, you might say. I can outdrink any of those homeless Indians and remain on my feet and still tell my stories. I get into arguments and fistfights with everybody. I get so angry that I go blind and deaf and mute. I like to start fires, and I'm ashamed that I'm a fire starter. I'm ashamed of everything, and I'm ashamed of being ashamed.
How would you describe this narrator of the story, this kid who goes by the name Zitz?
Narcissistic, disassociated, disenfranchised, borderline personality, orphan, biracial 15-year-old.
That's all.
Yeah, so in other words, your child. So yeah, a very, very disturbed young man who's lived in 20 different foster homes. And when we meet him, Zitz is his name, he's in his 21st foster home. And so after that long series of trials and tribulations, he violently assaults his foster parents and ends up in jail.
Now, he's also ready to explode. And in fact, early in the book, he walks into a bank with a couple of guns. One happens to be a paint gun, but no one else knows that. And he has some crazy anarchist idea about shooting up the place. And then suddenly, he's transported through a bit of time travel and ends up in the body of an FBI agent on an Indian reservation in 1975, and it's very heated there, moment of violent confrontation, and there are more episodes of time travel, more violence. Why were you so drawn to these scenes of violence?
Well, we've been in a war for longer than we were in World War II, so part of it is simply the carnage I read and see and hear every day going on in Iraq and in parts of the rest of the world. Darfur, Afghanistan. And so part of it is talking to my own sons, you know, 9 and 5, who see and hear this stuff and whose classmates are often playing war and often filtering their parents' political ideas and thoughts into the classrooms. So, you know, when your son comes home and says, you know, so-and-so said this about, you know, Muslims and so-and-so said this about George Bush and so-and-so said this about guns. And so in a way, I wrote it to my sons in a way. Of course, it's not geared toward a 9 and a 5-year-old, but I guess for future reference, when they ask me, I'll say, well, here's what I was thinking when you were 9.
That's interesting you say that because I have 2 kids, 11 and 9, and they have their own games of, you know, they love toy weapons and making crossbows and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's all fantasy. You know, we talk some about the war in Iraq, but that's way out there, and their fantasy is something totally different. Are you saying that maybe the two are not quite so separate?
Oh, no. Oh, the desire to make war is innate and inherent, especially in males. My oldest son does not play war, does not enjoy it. In fact, is always, when we do play games that involve conflict or war, is always trying to mediate, which angers his little brother beyond all belief. You know, the little 5-year-old warmonger. You know, we play a game called Heroescape, which is a variation of Dungeons & Dragons. It's tabletop with miniature figures. And, you know, I often try to introduce peaceful figures whose power is all about peace and who disarm people, and he can't stand that. And he said, this game is about war. So it's in us, all around us.
So that's interesting. I mean, so basically you're saying that you wrote, I mean, as far as I know, there are no references to the Iraq War in this novel. Maybe there are and I missed them. But you're saying that was really the spur that made you want to write this novel that really deals with this impulse towards violence, even though the particulars are totally different than what's happening.
The impulse toward violence, exactly. The thing that started it all, the direct genesis of it, was watching a documentary about 9/11. and they interviewed one of the flight instructors who taught the terrorists how to fly. And I realized as I was watching it, we'd never heard a word from these guys or even know who they were. And I was shocked that he was allowing himself to be interviewed. And he just kept saying that, you know, the terrorists would come to his apartment and they would drink and sing songs and tell stories, you know, get all drunk. And sometimes they'd be too drunk to drive home, so they would pass out on his couch. They would sleep on his couch. And so that personal betrayal, you know, set against the backdrop of that epic crime, just seems so huge to me. And it was an untold story about the violence.
Hmm. Now, one thing that you do in this novel is you kind of up the level of moral complication. It's not clear who the good guys and who the bad guys are, who the heroes are, who the victims are. And it's very obvious when your narrator, who keeps getting sent back into different periods of time, ends up in the body of an Indian kid during Little Bighorn, you know, the battle that killed Custer and all of his men. And, of course, the Indians at that time are furious. They've been getting wiped out. And this kid's father orders him to kill this young white soldier. It's a powerful scene. Would you be willing to read that for us?
Yes. All around me, Indian men, women, and children watch me. They all want revenge. They all want me to take revenge. The other white soldiers, bloody and broken, watch me. They know they are going to die, and they weep. They want to live. Yes, they are soldiers. They are killers. And they want to live. We all want to live. I don't know what to do here. I feel the anger building inside of me. I feel the need for revenge. My father yells at me in his language. He wants me to be a warrior. I'm only 12 or 13. This body I'm in is only 12 or 13. I am only a child. I stare at the white soldier in front of me. He's probably 18, younger. He's 17 or 16 or 15. He's a child, and I'm a child, and I'm supposed to slash his throat. What do I do? I close my eyes.
Wow. What were you doing with that scene? Where did that come from for you?
Well, another one of those untold stories of history or unexamined moments. When you think about the Battle of the Little Bighorn, the accepted liberal notion of it is that it's the last victory of Native Americans against colonial forces. It was that. It was a military victory, an astounding military victory. But at a certain point during the day, after the battle was won, the Indians continued, and they committed atrocities. They tortured and mutilated living and dead soldiers. And so at some point during that day, a military victory became a series of war crimes. And that's not really talked about. You know, as Zitz himself says, how do you tell the difference between the good and the bad guys when they say the same things? But also, how do you tell the difference between the good and the bad guys when they do the same things? So Little Bighorn is contrasted with a Sand Creek-type massacre in this book as well, where Zitz drops into the body of an Indian tracker, a white guy named Gus, who leads a cavalry unit into a defenseless Indian village and watches the slaughter. So, you know, it's hard to know. You know, at some point, heroes and victims are interchangeable. The oppressed and the oppressors are interchangeable. The good and the bad are interchangeable. And that we're all veering between those extremes all the time.
Are you saying there aren't heroes and victims, or that we can't just fascinate on one particular person because it's fluid? It kind of moves back and forth.
There are heroic moments. You know, I don't believe in heroes. I believe in heroic ideas and heroic moments, and I don't think any of us live up to that label. I think we all have heroic moments, but we all have incredibly villainous moments as well. This country, United States, is heroic and villainous.
Do you see that in your own life? I mean, you have...
Myself?
Sure.
Oh, constantly. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, on one level, I'm an artist sharing with the world and helping a lot of people. I see that all the time. I get the letters. I talk to people. The big crowds come and I move them. But I'm also an incredibly self-involved, narcissistic, arrogant fool. So, you know, in the course of 5 minutes during any performance or any interview, I veer between those extremes where I'm concerned about the world. And then all of a sudden, I'm only worried about my book sales. So even in a minor life like mine, I veer between extremes constantly.
So as an artist, I mean, sort of knowing that and knowing that about yourself and about, you know, all of the rest of us as well, are you then trying to show that? I mean, show that, you know, this is the way human beings are?
I hope, I guess. I mean, it's an argument against fundamentalism. Really, because fundamentalism, by definition, believes you are only one thing. You belong strictly to one idea, one concept, one definition. And so by showing all these permutations of human behavior and the way in which we're all a part of it, you know, maybe that's a way of me saying, you know, no to fundamentalism. Certainly, I had some fundamentalist attitudes before 9/11 about race and tribe, but they started disappearing on that day. And people say, oh, no, that can't be, it can't happen that quickly. But it did.
What were your fundamentalist attitudes?
You know, in terms of lefty politics, my idea that the United States was an imperialistic country, my idea about Indian identity and maintaining its sovereignty, you know, its purity, the notion of purity of identity, I had a lot of those attitudes. But I saw the end game of tribalism on September 11th. And the end game of tribalism is flying planes into buildings. So since then, I've embraced the idea that I belong to multiple tribes and that I join a new one every few weeks, depending on something I've fallen in love with. You know, I'm reading this incredible book by James Boyce called MVP. It's about a novel about a Kobe Bryant-esque professional basketball player who becomes involved in a rape murder. It's an amazing first novel. And so now I'm in the Kevin Boyce tribe. You know, it's probably a small tribe right now, but I think it's going to grow. So that's how I look at the world now. I'm still essentially a Spokane Coeur d'Alene Indian, but I'm also from Washington State. I'm also from the Pacific Northwest. I'm also an American. I'm a Democrat, I'm a liberal, you know, I'm straight, I'm a father, I'm a son, I'm you know, a husband. I like tortilla chips and salsa. I like five-star Thai food. And so all of these things define me, and not any one of them is who I am. I'm some strange, random, you know, ever-changing synthesis of all those things. And so that's my argument against fundamentalism, you know, to quote that other fundamentalist Walt Whitman, you know, you know, I contain multitudes.
Sherman Alexie is a critically acclaimed writer from Washington. His book of short stories, Lone Ranger and Tonto Fistfight in Heaven, was the basis for the film Smoke Signals. His latest novel is called Flight. He talked with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Mike Ewing, Charles Monroe Kane, Anne Strainchamps, and Doug Gordon. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. Kirill Owen is our technical director. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Learning Outside the Box. Number 39A. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email at ttbook.org. We always love to hear from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.